Good afternoon and welcome to The Insiders, offering insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm your host, Maria Armudian. In this hour, how water shaped our past and how new water challenges are shaping our future. We'll discuss the nearly secret life of water. Then on the Scholar's Circle, political power is changing. We'll explore what power is, who has power, and how new developments are changing all of that. Although it's the most important substance in our lives, we hardly think about water, where it comes from, how it's used, and its precarious future. Water determines the outcome of just about everything, the fate of cities, the production of everything from a pair of jeans, a flat-screen TV, to concrete and food. All that is alive is completely dependent on it. And now, as our water sources and water purity are increasingly threatened by overuse, pollution, climate change, and a growing human population, it is going to reshape how we live. Perhaps it is time to learn about this profoundly important substance, according to our next guest. Award-winning author and journalist Charles Fishman joins us now to discuss his latest book, The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. Welcome, Charles Fishman.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. Perhaps we should start with a few water facts. You start with the ways in which we use and need water in your book and the ways that we waste it. Give us some numbers. Give us the scope.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The average American uses 99 gallons of real water a day for things like taking a bath, washing your hands, boiling pasta, making coffee, flushing the toilet. But just at home, the electricity that each of us uses at home is 250 gallons of water a day. So 10 gallons an hour, every hour of every day for each of us, not per family, to keep the computers running and the flat screen TV on and the refrigerator cold. We need more than twice as much water to make the electricity that our homes use as we do for the actual water we use. That's just a tiny example. Everybody's omnipresent cell phones, their laptop computers, their tablet computers, every computer chip in the world requires a kind of water that is so clean, it is literally considered too clean to drink. Drinking it would leach the nutrients right back out of your body. And so again, whoever imagines that their iPhone requires water or a particular kind of sort of exotic water, you know, there's water required for almost everything we do, and most of it is hidden.
Now, compare the United States water usage with the rest of the world. Walk us through that.
Well, the Americans, as with many other things in the world, Americans are large consumers of water. On a per capita basis, in the developed world, we're the largest users of water out there. But per capita water use is a little misleading. For instance, all of the agriculture in the United States, the per capita water use, the per person water use in the country, includes all the farmers and all the power plants. So industrialized nations end up with pretty high per person water use. What's interesting in the United States is that as a country, we use more water in a day than we use oil in a year. And I think that's so startling because you hear so much about the price of oil and so much about the availability of oil. We literally use more water in a single day than we use oil in a whole year as a country. And look how little attention water gets. And I think this is one of the most hopeful things I discovered in reporting this book. The United States actually uses less water today as a country than we did in 1980. We've gotten much more efficient in the big users of water over the last 25, 30 years. So we use less water to produce an economy of $13 trillion than we did to produce an economy of $6 trillion. We've literally doubled the economic output of the country without increasing the amount of water we needed to use at all. And that's pretty impressive.
One of the things you point out is that some 40% of the world doesn't have good access to water. So give us the lay of the land here. Who has it? Who doesn't? And what is this phrase, water wealth and water poverty?
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, it is not that much different than other necessities of life in the world. People of means, people with good jobs, people who live in developed world countries have such good access to water that they never think about it. So there are very small pockets of the United States that don't have good water service, and unfortunately those are mostly on the reservations of Native American peoples. But in general, 97% of Americans have such good water service they never think about it. The same is true across the developed world, in Canada, across Europe. The water service is so good it's invisible, and it's also incredibly inexpensive. We never even think about the price of water. In fact, across the U.S., not only don't ordinary people think about the price of their water at home, most businesses don't have to think about the price of water at all. Most farmers don't think about the price of water. They just use it. The 40% of people who don't have good access to water, that's amazing. Think about that for a minute. Wherever you work, whatever restaurant you're in, whatever school you go to, look to the left and the right. 4 out of 10 people in the world don't have good access to water, and yet we don't know anybody like that, although it's almost half the world. So about 15 to 20% of the world literally does not have access to clean, safe water. They drink muddy water and very small amounts, whatever they can get every day. And another 20% of the world has to walk every single day to get water. For that 40% of the world, water is actually probably the thing they think about most in their day. It shapes, access to water shapes their entire day. The 20% of the world that relies on walking to get water, they start the day walking to get water, and they end the day walking to get water. And if they're lucky, there are 3 or 4 hours in the middle of the day where they don't have to worry about fetching water. The availability of water literally determines whether people can go to school, what their access to, you know, economic opportunities and good jobs are. So I use the phrase water poverty and water wealth because I think lack of water doesn't just impoverish you in terms of the water, it actually impoverishes you in the larger sense because lack of access to water limits your other economic opportunities.
And what's happening now, as you point out, is that water access and access to clean water is changing as a result of all kinds of developments, including climate change and including the new pollutants that are the micropollutants that you talk about. Give us a little bit of a sketch of what happened, for example, in Spain and what happened in some of the places in the United States as well in roughly 2008. Walk us through, starting with Spain.
Well, Spain was one of the European countries that was hit by a terrible drought, the area of Catalonia. And Barcelona, which is an enormous city of 5 million people, was running so short of water that they actually established an emergency pipeline project to bring water in from another region. They were building a water pipeline right down the middle of a superhighway. They used the right-of-way between the lanes going in opposite directions, and they were spending roughly $40 million to build that pipeline. And Barcelona was so concerned about water, they turned off the fountains. That's a city that is famous for its fountains. They turned off the beachside showers and started trying to, they contracted to bring in water by tanker, the same kind of tankers that move oil around the world, although these were obviously food-grade tankers. They hadn't been carrying petroleum any time recently. But it was a kind of silly gesture. It cost millions and millions of dollars, and twice a week a tanker would pull up to the docks in Barcelona. The docks had been modified to accommodate the ships, and those ships unloaded their entire cargoes of water, and it would provide 35 minutes of water for the city. And so what it really served to do was illustrate that you have to manage water problems in a much larger framework. If you get desperate and you're running a city of millions of people, tankers full of water will not rescue you. You have to have thought a little further ahead. In the United States, Atlanta also came close to running out of water. They rely on a nearby reservoir, and the reservoir dropped so that Atlanta really only had about 80 days of water. And again, Atlanta has doubled in size and doubled in size again since about 1970. And yet the people responsible for managing Atlanta's growth and for making sure Atlanta has what it needs have never gone and tried to get secure new water supplies for the city. Atlanta actually sits in a pretty water-wealthy region in terms of natural rainfall and nearby lakes and so forth. But as the city began to run short of water, it was too late to go laying. You can't lay emergency pipelines for a city of 4 or 5 million people in 2 months. Things like that take planning, time, permitting. I hope that those kinds of examples, which I describe in some detail in the book, will sort of serve as a wake-up call. Atlanta is the perfect example of a place that has never thought about its water supply, and yet when a two-year-long drought settled in over the southeastern United States, all across Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, the water supplies dried up, and cities large and small found themselves in difficult positions. I think the point of telling those stories is to say both citizens and the people in charge of government and water supplies need to say, you know, it may be the case that the water situation we live with every day now might change. If the rainfall here fell 20 or 30% 3 years in a row, what would our water situation be then, and what can we do in advance? It's like having a fire extinguisher. You're never sorry you did some good water planning in advance. You know, you don't look at the fire extinguisher on your sink in the kitchen or on the wall at the office and say, "Boy, that was a waste of money." If you need it, you're really glad it's there.
I thought it was quite funny that the way Georgia tried to handle their water crisis was by moving their border.
Well, it happens that Georgia and Atlanta sit just below the Tennessee River. And even in the midst of this drought, the Tennessee River is such a big river that there was more than enough water in it. But the Georgia border is below the Tennessee River. All they would need to do would have been to have had a border a mile further to the north. And so the Georgia legislature voted to move the border. Thank goodness states don't get to determine their own borders. And the Tennessee legislature was not interested in ceding any part of the Tennessee River to their neighbors to the south. There'd been no reason, of course. It's a funny example and silly, and it shows, you know, how absurd supposedly responsible people will be when it comes to solving water problems. But there had been no reason they couldn't have negotiated to get water from the Tennessee River in advance before the crisis, in case a crisis came along. Why wouldn't Tennessee have been willing to sell some of that water? It's just flowing down the river anyway, right? So it's both silly but also an example of how, if you think far enough in advance, most water problems turn out not to be water problems. They turn out to be people problems.
The New York Times today, I believe this was on the front page, the lead in a story about China's water crisis said, quote, "North China is dying. A chronic drought is ravaging farmland. The Gobi Desert is inching south. The Yellow River, the so-called birthplace of Chinese civilization, is so polluted it can no longer supply drinking water." It's really a global problem. You also talked about Australia at length, about all of the problems in Australia. And the weather patterns are changing.
Absolutely. So, yes, the story of the New York Times about China is about China deciding that it's going to move enormous volumes of water from one part of the country to the other. The story described it as supplying water to Boston, New York, and Washington using canals from the Mississippi River. If you can imagine a canal that would cross all of Kentucky, Ohio, Massachusetts, New York, you know, another one arcing down toward Washington, D.C. Well, they're actually trying to do that in China with all kinds of implications. Now, that looks kind of astonishing and in some ways desperate to us. We, of course, did the same thing out west. I mean, that's how California, Arizona, and Las Vegas, Nevada are supplied with water, with big diversion projects and big dam projects. We just did them 60 or 70 years ago, and so we've grown accustomed to them. I'm going to take issue with one thing you said. I think it's dangerous to say it's a global problem. The problems that are happening in North China and the problems that happened in Atlanta and the problems that happened in Barcelona and the problems that happened in Australia aren't directly connected to each other. That is, we can say, oh boy, those folks down in Atlanta sure are in trouble, but I live in Philadelphia. Even if we have lots of water here, and we do, there's no way of helping the people in Atlanta. The people in Atlanta have to solve their own water problem. We can be sympathetic to the problems of China or sympathetic to the problems of Australia, but each region, even within those countries, has to tackle its own water problem. You know, the people in Orlando can't help the people in Atlanta. And if you all in California figure out how to solve your water problems, the good news is the people in Minnesota can't undo it. They can't take some action that will undo your solution. So I think while lots of places in the world are having water problems at the same time, and the reasons for those water problems are related sort of thematically, climate change, economic development, growing population, it's important to remember that water problems are local, and the people who are having the problems have the ability in general to grab hold of them and figure out how to solve them. But polluted rivers in China means there's water, and there's somebody tainting the water, making it unusable, but there is water available. And so you could begin to fix the problem by not allowing people to destroy the water supply that you rely on, for instance. I think it's important to understand that while there may be this sort of outbreak of water problems in lots of different places around the world, it's not like the global economic crisis. You have to solve your own water problems, and most of the time, the tools to solve those problems are right at hand if we're willing to look at them clearly.
Well, let's talk about one of those examples. You noted that Las Vegas, which is the casino capital and has been using enormous amounts of water for its entertainment, and it's in the middle of a desert. You noted that they actually came up with some interesting creative solutions to keep this kind of crazy water display going. Talk about what happened.
Well, Las Vegas is a really interesting case. It's the driest city in America by far. Of the 280 largest cities in America, 280 gets you pretty far down the list. Las Vegas is far and away the driest. They get 4 inches of rain a year. It only rains about 20 days a year in Las Vegas. The temperature is over 100 for something like 75 days. So it's over 100 degrees in Las Vegas many more days a year than it actually rains. And Las Vegas relies on essentially a single source for all its water, Lake Mead, which is an enormous reservoir just outside the city. Lake Mead's actually 110 miles long, vast lake that is backed up by Hoover Dam. But Las Vegas can't take whatever it wants from Lake Mead. Las Vegas is limited by federal agreement to a very specific amount of water that hasn't changed in 50 years. So Las Vegas has, like Atlanta, Las Vegas has grown like mad. It, too, has doubled and doubled again in the last 30 years in terms of population, 3 or 4 times the number of people living there now as living there in 1970, but no new water available at all. And so Las Vegas really has had to reimagine how a city like that can manage its water use because it's only got one slug of water. They've imposed all kinds of fascinating rules to change the culture. It is now illegal in Las Vegas to have a front lawn. All new houses, starting back in about 2000, are forbidden to have front lawns. And those same houses are only allowed grass on half of whatever the backyard is. The rest of the landscaping needs to be indigenous desert landscaping appropriate to Las Vegas. Well, 70% of the water that homeowners use in Las Vegas goes to watering the lawn. So if you begin to reduce the amount of lawn there is, then you begin to gradually over time reduce the amount of water they use. It's illegal to let your lawn sprinklers, if you're part of the grandfathered group or whatever lawn you have, it's illegal to let them hit the pavement or hit a road. They must hit only landscaped areas. And they actually have water cops who will find you. They specify the kind of hose nozzle you can use to wash your car. It has to have an automatic shutoff. It only works when you're pressing on it. So they tell you what days you can water the lawn and what hours you can water, because watering in the middle of the day in the middle of the desert means you're wasting enormous quantities of water that simply evaporate, that never do any good for your lawn. The most important thing Las Vegas has done, though, is a kind of hidden measure, which is really important. Las Vegas collects every drop of water that is used indoors anywhere in the city, cleans it to a much higher level than is typical in most American cities, and returns it right to Lake Mead. Las Vegas recycles more than 90% of the water that hits a drain anywhere in the metro region. So they actually reuse their water over and over again. They clean it clean enough to put back in Lake Mead and get ready to be taken out again. And that's a number no American city can even come close to that Las Vegas hits. That also means you're not allowed to empty your swimming pool into a storm drain in Las Vegas. You're not allowed to empty your hot tub into a storm drain. You have to empty it right into the sanitary sewer. Because if you're going to dump 10,000 gallons worth of swimming pool water, they want it right back in the system, cleaned up, and returned to Lake Mead, not sprayed out across your lawn. The result is that they have really changed how people think about water and water use in Las Vegas. And over the last 20 years, they've reduced the per-person use of water by 30%. And so they've been able to grow the city without having to add water sources by changing how people use their water and even how they think about it. You know, no one would imagine letting their sprinkler spray on a hot road, which is something that happens all the time across America.
Let's talk for a minute about bottled water.
Okay.
And as you pointed out, a lot of times, you know, our infrastructure starts to fall apart. People don't want to pay for the infrastructure. They say, we'll buy bottled water. That doesn't work for multiple reasons. Give us the cost, the collective cost of bottled water on our system, and also give us the truth about bottled water.
Well, it's interesting. I got started on the path to writing The Big Thirst with a story about bottled water. I spent several months trying to understand the bottled water business. I grew up in the 1960s and 1970s when there was no bottled water at all. We used water fountains. We drank out of the tap at home. There literally was no bottled water business. And I was puzzled as a journalist where the business had come from. After all, we're buying something in stores that is literally free in our homes. And there are lots of things we're very touchy about the price of, so why would we be spending money for something we get free? You asked about the cost, and I think this is one of the more striking things, another way that we sort of don't connect the dots in the water world. In the United States, we spend $21 billion a year on bottled water as consumers every year, $21 billion a year. We spend $29 billion a year maintaining the entire water infrastructure of the country, all the treatment plants, the pumps, the pipes, modernization, maintenance, the whole thing. So we spend almost as much on crushable plastic bottles filled with water as we do on the entire critical infrastructure for the country. So when people say to me there's no money in the system for fixing the water system, I just laugh and say, no, actually there is. In fact, we're already spending that money on water. It's just coming one little plastic bottle at a time. I actually don't think it's my job or anybody's job to tell you whether to drink bottled water or not. I think if people understand it, they'll be a little less inclined to drink it. It's not my job to tell you whether you should be drinking Fiji water or San Pellegrino or Evian, but those products do leave an incredible trail behind them. Only about 25% of the plastic bottles get recycled. So 75% of the plastic bottles in which bottled water is delivered end up in the landfill, which is just ridiculous. You think about that plastic bottle as a kind of a permanent container. It will never go away. 100 years ago, it would have been considered a miracle to have a bottle that was that light and that strong that you could use over and over again. We literally take 4 swallows of water, and then we throw the 1,000-year container in the garbage. Anybody who's drinking bottled water should at least take the trouble to make sure the container gets recycled. And the truth is, some people drink bottled water because they like the taste. Some people think it's safer. It is certainly no safer than tap water. In fact, it is not as closely regulated as tap water. So there are people who say they can tell the difference. In blind taste tests with water exactly the same temperature, almost no one, including the bottled water people, can ever tell the difference. And the truth is, you drink tap water, it's a little warm out of the tap. You drink bottled water, it's ice cold out of the refrigerator case in the store or out of your own refrigerator. Plus, it comes in the bottle, so you sort of have a psychological association. But it is absolutely no safer. And part of the impact is what we started out talking about, which is bottled water will not save you. Atlanta could not have relied on bottled water if Lake Lanier, its reservoir, ran desperately low. There's not enough bottled water in the country to keep even one city going on a regular basis. I think bottled water has a tendency to undermine confidence in tap water, and the truth is that the municipal water system of the country is vital to the economic vibrancy of the country. We need to not confuse bottled water with municipal water systems.
Let's talk for a moment about the Safe Drinking Water Act. You noted that it's 35 years old and it has 91 contaminants that it regulates, but there are a whole host of new ones, micropollutants, drugs. What is the reality of the pollutants in our water and in contrast with the Safe Drinking Water Act?
Well, the Safe Drinking Water Act has been updated a couple times in the last 30 years, but it's clearly out of date compared to what the threats to the water supply are. And anybody who's listening can sort of just think about themselves and the people they know. I don't think my parents took any medicines routinely when they were the age that I am. You know, we not only take Motrin and acetaminophen when our backs bother us in middle age, plenty of people are on maintenance high blood pressure drugs, maintenance cholesterol drugs, maintenance birth control pills that didn't even exist 50 years ago, maintenance antidepressants. So all of that stuff is great in medical terms, but a little bit of it leaks out of our bodies every time we pee, and it ends up in the toilet, and it ends up in the water supply. And the current treatment plant, the wastewater treatment plants that the water goes to from your home, and the water treatment plants that are responsible for cleaning fresh water and delivering it to us at the front end, none of those are set up to take out this class of kind of pharmaceutical, what I call micropollutant. These products appear in absolutely minuscule quantities. An average person might earn $10 million in the course of an entire life of earnings, and these micropollutants appear in the equivalent of less than one penny out of $10 million, a lifetime's earnings. So very, very small quantities. And yet, we keep adding, and these drugs are specifically designed to have an impact at minuscule levels. Your question was, what's the truth about those pollutants? And unfortunately, the truth is we don't know. We don't know what impact they have on human beings. They clearly have an impact on fish and other marine and amphibious life when those pollutants begin to accumulate in lakes and rivers and bodies of water. Now, of course, the fish and the amphibians are living in the water. They're not drinking, you know, a liter a day. They're actually swimming through it and breathing it all the time. So they're much more likely to be sensitive and much more likely to be affected by small quantities. Those things can, in fact, be taken out of the water. It's not actually a technical challenge at all. It's simply a financial challenge. Only about 10% of the water that each of us uses each day is used for potable purposes. Most of it, 90% of it, goes for things that don't require purified water. If you were to take all those micropollutants out of every gallon of municipal water in the country, you'd double the water bill. Now, of course, the water bill is only $35 a month on average, $34 a month on average for an American home. So even doubling the water bill would barely bring it up to what our cell phones cost. But Americans wouldn't tolerate that. We need a new sort of focus of research on what those micropollutants do both to us and to the environment where they sit after we, you know, use those products and the wastewater is discharged into a river or a lake or wherever. And we probably need a little bit of a technical leap to take those micropollutants back out. And the place to take them out isn't before we drink the water, but at the point at which wastewater is treated, so that we don't actually taint the environment where the water is deposited with these man-made pharmaceuticals, the impact of which we're just trying to understand. We're ready for a kind of new, a second revolution in water cleanliness, and I hope that gets enough attention. That is something people pay attention to. They don't want Prozac in their drinking water, even in very small quantities.
Well, Charles Fishman, the book is called The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, new global developments are changing the structure and holders of power. But what exactly does it mean to have power, and where does power come from? Stay tuned.
Put your stuff in our hands so our voices can be heard. And
Good afternoon and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm your host, Maria Armudian. New global developments are changing the structures and the holders of power. With new technology and greater interconnectedness, states are losing power and non-state actors are gaining power. But what exactly does it mean to have power, and where exactly does power come from? That's the subject explored by our next esteemed panel. We are joined by three experts on political power. Joseph Nye is the University Distinguished Service Professor at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. He has published numerous books, including Soft Power, The Means to Success in World Politics, The Powers to Lead, and his latest, The Future of Power. Giulio Gallerati is professor of government in the College of Social Studies at Wesleyan University. He is the author of The Power Curse, Influence and Illusion in World Politics and Cosmopolitan Power in International Relations, a Synthesis of Realism, Neorealism, and Constructivism. Erica Chenoweth is professor of government at Wesleyan University and director of the Wesleyan Program on Terrorism and Insurgency Research. She's currently a visiting scholar at the Institute of International Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. She is co-author of Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict, and co-editor of Rethinking Violence, States and Non-State Actors in Conflict. I think what I'd like to do is start with the concept itself of political power. Of course, this has been long debated in political scientist circles. And an old definition emerging from a scholar, Laswell, said it was who gets what, when, and how. Of course, there have been plenty of others along the way. Professor Dahl and his contemporary said power is the ability to influence or cause change socially, politically, or economically. So why don't we start with what we mean by political power and where it comes from, who has it and who doesn't, and why. Joseph Nye, I'm going to start with you.
Well, I use a definition of power that's pretty close to what the dictionary says. It's the ability to get what you want by affecting others. And you can do this in three basic ways. You can do it with threats of coercion, so-called sticks. You can do it with payments, so-called carrots. Or you can do it by getting others to want what you want. And that's what I call soft power. And if you're able to attract others and get them to do what you want without having to coerce them or pay them, you can save a lot of carrots and sticks. So for me, power is that ability to get the outcomes you want, and those are the three ways you can do it.
Can you give us some examples of what you are talking about with the soft power in terms of politics?
Let me give you an example from Dwight Eisenhower, who was not only a president, but also a general before that. He said at one point, giving somebody a command is not very hard. Getting somebody to do something for you because they want to, he says, that's really hard. And so soft power is that ability to attract others, to get them to do something you want because they want to, not because you're coercing them or paying them.
And where do we see this in terms of the international playing field?
Well, we see it internationally when you come to situations where you can bomb another country or pay another country, or you can get another country to follow you because they're attracted. It's easier to see in the reverse situations. In 2003, President Bush wanted to send American troops into Iraq by having them cross Turkey, and he offered the Turkish government a very large aid package, essentially a bribe. The Turks turned it down because America had become so unpopular, it had lost so much of its soft power of attraction, that the Turkish parliament refused to go along with it. So the 4th Infantry Division, which was supposed to cross Turkey and enter Iraq from the north, had to go down through the canal and up through the Gulf and was late to the war. That's a case where the lack of soft power inhibited American hard power.
I think that's going to lead us later into the discussion about just causes and ethics and where those fall into the realm of soft power. But before we go into that, Giulio Gallerati, let's bring you in. Can you also talk about who has power and why?
Well, to pick up on what Joe said, and obviously he invented these concepts and they're very important. And a lot of people are talking about them, not just among scholars, but also in the press and, of course, in politics. I wanted to kind of say that the way I conceptualize the difference between hard powers, hard power is a way of coercing people to do what you want. Soft power is a way of cultivating compliance. That's the main difference. That's how I see it. I'd also like to add that the world has changed such that the utility of soft power has increased significantly, and the utility of hard power has decreased significantly, all because of some major changes in the international system over the past 100 years. First of all, because we have a security community among developed nations, and this idea of security community was introduced by Robert Jervis, who suggests that war between major powers is almost unthinkable. Now, in a situation where war and violence between major powers is unthinkable, heavy-handed methods that derive from hard power don't have much utility. People will find it much more difficult to use hard power to get what they want in that situation. Two other changes. One, the growth of economic interdependence. And where you have interdependent agents, it's very difficult, again, to use hard power, heavy-handed methods to get things, because you're both dependent on one another. You're mutually vulnerable. In a case like this, again, soft power is the way to go. And globalization has, of course, reinforced interdependence. Another change has been the rise of democracies, where you have national leaders and populations that fundamentally believe in the rule of law. And in an environment where people do believe in the rule of law, soft power gains much greater utility and much greater respect. Of course, we've also had a proliferation in the number of international organizations in the world and regimes, such that while the system is still anarchic, we've taken greater steps in moving toward a system which is governed much more by the rule of law. And in systems governed by the rule of law, hard power, which really has utility most in pure anarchy, really loses a lot of its utility. So I wanted to add that onto what Professor Nye has already said.
You bring a lot of really important points up in terms of the rule of law, and I think that is going to beg the question about some of the activities related to the United States itself and the issues of torture and the issues of United Nations resolutions and the contradictions there that I'd like to get into. But before we do that, Erica Chinwith, let's bring you in. You've actually looked at this relationship between state and non-state actors and related in part to democracy, and you've shown by your research the power of this soft power. Give us a thumbnail sketch of what you found.
Well, the way I'm thinking about power these days is a pretty simple definition, which is the ability to get people to obey. And the less it costs for a state to get people to obey, the more powerful they are. In other words, if a state doesn't have to invest that much in domestic security because people are more or less well-behaved and see the government as more or less legitimate, then that's a pretty powerful state. Whereas, counterintuitively, the states that have to spend a ton of money on internal security, like Egypt, for example, under Mubarak, they end up not being as powerful as they look on paper because they don't have the legitimacy that is required to be able to control the population, which is why Mubarak subsequently was ousted. And so my research basically looks at people as the source of power, that is, the population within the state, rather than sort of a top-down definition, because a state is only as powerful, or a leader is only as powerful, as their ability to convince not only the population to behave, but also the people that work for them. So the security forces, the economic elites, the civilian bureaucrats, as soon as those people stop obeying the authority of the leader, you can see that power crumbling. So I think that power really requires obedience in some sense. And what we're seeing around the world these days is sort of a corrosion of the sources of legitimacy that a lot of dictators have taken for granted.
I think you bring up a couple of really important points. One is legitimacy. And I think all three of you have talked about legitimacy a bit. Joseph Nye, let's bring you back in on this. You've talked about perceived legitimacy and this being, I think you called it, the third face of power. How does one become considered legitimate, perceived as legitimate? And how does that translate into power?
Well, legitimacy is a power reality. I mean, human beings don't act simply because they're coerced or because they're paid. We also act because of moral concerns, because we think something is right. And legitimacy is when others think that you have rightful authority. So the question of where that comes from is hotly debated. I mean, based back in the days of monarchies, it was the divine right of kings. What Max Weber pointed out was that it transfers also to the modern rational bureaucratic state. If a state is elected and has a well-ordered government, that's often seen as legitimate. But also legitimacy can be generated by charismatic leaders, somebody who has a particular attractive personality, which seems to give them a sense of right. So there are a variety of sources of legitimacy. I've just mentioned the famous Weberian trio. But in today's modern world, you can see that certain ideas of democracy and human rights and freedoms and so forth are often sources of legitimacy, but they don't necessarily transfer across all cultures. What seems legitimate in the eyes of Americans may not look legitimate in the eyes of Saudi Arabians. So there are various sources of legitimacy, but the common denominator is that people are moved not just by carrots and sticks, but also by a feeling of what's right.
So that's the issue of ethics, morality, or a just cause.
Yeah, morality is a power of reality. I mean, it's as simple as that.
So how does that fit in now with the idea of, say, and this actually fits with something else you've talked about, Joseph Nye, in your latest book, which is the issue of imperialism. You use the phrase imperial overstretch, and that having compromised the United States' power potentially because of this moral issue. And last time you and I spoke, I asked you, isn't all imperialism imperial overstretch?
Well, imperial overstretch is the term was used by Paul Kennedy, the famous Yale historian, referred to the fact that as countries try to control areas beyond their borders, it becomes more and more expensive for them. And this indeed is what happened to the Soviet Union. The cost of military budget rose and rose so that eventually it became something like 22% of their gross domestic product. And so the more you try to control what's overseas, the more your expenses in the military sense go up as a percent of the total, and that's imperial overstretch. The United States doesn't fit that model in the following sense, that military budget's about 5% of our gross domestic product today, and that's has half of what it was during the Cold War. So rather than increasingly being overstretched budgetary terms over a long historical period like the Soviet Union was, we have not been. In the short run, right now of our current budgetary crisis, there is some tension between overseas operations like Afghanistan and the American military budget. But I don't really see the American situation as one of imperial overstretch in the sense that Kennedy defined the term.
Giulio Gallerati, would you agree?
I'm going to have to disagree with Joe on this, probably the first time I ever have. I do think that we're in a situation now where we have unrivaled hegemony. We have a global presence that's never been seen in history. Over 700 bases in 130 countries with roughly 4.5 million people, both civilian and military, carrying on operations. We're spending $400 million a day in Afghanistan and Iraq alone. Our power in nuclear weapons is unrivaled. And, of course, you know, we spend, you know, the famous fact that we spend, the military budget is a little less than the rest of the world combined. I do think that we are in a situation where we can no longer rule the world and deliver the American dream. And I think of this quote by Lao Tzu in the Tao Te Ching, who said, "He who commands others is powerful, but he who masters himself is mightier still." I think in this particular case, we have an interesting paradox of external power, external hegemony, and internal weakness. I do believe we have some severe domestic problems. And even though Joe's quite right that if you look at it in terms of GNP and a comparative study, our defense spending is not exaggerated. However, when you consider the sensitive situation our domestic economy and society is in, we do see that there's a trade-off. And we are, at this point, a society in disrepair, I think, with 50 million people uninsured and with middle-class people being unable to afford the full price of health care insurance, and they're unable to afford tuitions at elite colleges. our government deficit at this point is literally threatening the very institutions that undergird our social safety net, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. This country, as rich as it is 21st in literacy. Our public education is deteriorating, and we have millions of people in prison and millions of people homeless. So I do think that even though as a percentage of GNP it's small, you know, some kind of redistribution of that money to these domestic problems would make great contributions to alleviating these problems. So I'm going to disagree a little bit with Joe on this.
I want to also ask you, Giulio Gallerati, is there a relationship between all of this spending and presence in other countries and their own struggles for democracy and the soft power of the United States as you see it?
Well, we don't really have an empire in a classical definition in terms of having colonies. I think Chalmers Johnson is the one that pushed this phrase, an American empire. I think what we're really talking about is just the present. And clearly we have many, many bases, as I've said, and in some of these situations, there's really no conflict of interest. People are happy to have us there. The military are providing a number of public goods to the various communities. In fact, paradoxically, the military bases provide a lot of infrastructure and public goods. So in a sense, they're providing a lot of soft power themselves. But other occupations, for example, Afghanistan and Iraq, they're quite different in nature. And so I think what you're seeing is, in terms of our military presence and what it means, there's definitely a mixed bag. It's not all evil, but it definitely generates points of controversy that cut against our legitimacy and influence in the world.
Erica Chin, with anything you'd like to add?
What occurred to me when I was listening to my colleagues is just that there is a group of scholars who argue that you can't really think of power, or at least American hegemony, in absolute terms. So a better question to ask sometimes is not just is American hegemony declining, but is it declining relative to other competitors or rival powers who are increasing in their power? And fortunately or unfortunately for the United States, many of its rivals at the moment are also suffering recession, or they have, as in China, significant development challenges that make it a long way off from being a real competitor. But nevertheless, there is a finite amount of power that any one country can accumulate, even if it is the most powerful country in the world at a given time. Basically, the history of international relations has been substitutions of empires, you know, one after the other. It was Britain and then the U.S. and the USSR and the U.S. and then who knows who's next. It rotates. Given where other great powers are today, that we don't really have to worry about any type of steep decline in the immediate future.
Joseph Nye, let's bring you back in. You've talked about how power is changing now in the 21st century, in part due to the economics, in part due to natural resources. You see a new rise of some states and a decline of others. How do you see this shaping up?
Well, I argue in the future of power that there are two big power shifts going on in this century. One is a shift from west to east, which you might call the recovery of Asia, so that Asia will recover during this century to being more than half the world's population and half the world's product, which is where it was before the Industrial Revolution in the West. That's a good process. That means more people are escaping poverty. It does, though, mean that there's a fear in some cases, for example, that China will become a considerable competitor and take over from the United States. I agree with Eric, as I said, that that's not imminent, and Asia has its own internal balance of power. The Japanese and Indians and Vietnamese don't want the Chinese to take over, and in that sense, they want an American presence. So I think there is a big power shift from west to east, but Asia is not one thing. I think the Americans are not about to be overtaken by China. I do think, however, that the second power shift that I talk about, which is the shift of power away from all governments to non-governmental actors, is something that is more of concern. And that really is the effect of the enormous change that the information revolution has brought about, of reducing the barriers to entry, of playing a direct role in international politics. It's not that the governments are obsolete, but it just means the stage on which governments act is a lot more crowded, because players who were previously priced out of the action can now play in the game. And that we see most dramatically in the area of cyber power. You can be attacked now and don't know whether it's an attack by a hacker or by a criminal group or by another state. And so individuals or private actors are able to do things which previously were restricted primarily to governments. So these are the two big power shifts I see going on among states from west to east and among all states from states to non-state actors.
When you talked about non-state actors in your book, when you wrote about them, one of the other emerging non-state actors that you talked about having an enormous amount of power now are these international corporations because of the massive amounts of money that they move around. You said they're bigger than many states. Can you talk about what the effect of that is?
Yeah, the transnational corporation has been around for a long time, but its power has been increased by the information revolution, so that now you can find companies which will operate in dozens of countries with hundreds of thousand employees and able to shift the sources of the goods or sales quite quickly because of the Internet. And they can also shift vast amounts of money. I mean, you can get transactions, in some cases, can be bigger than the budgets of some countries. So there is enormous power in corporations. But it's one more thing worth noticing about corporations is that well-organized governments have three sources of power: their military capacity, their economic capacity, and their legitimacy. Corporations rarely have military capacity, and they may have legitimacy, but it's questionable in some cases. So they really are resting a lot of their power heavily on one leg of the stool, which is the economic leg.
Which is a pretty powerful leg.
Very much so. Very much so.
Well, Erica Chenoweth, since we're talking about non-state actors and since you study people and revolutionary movements, can you talk about the rise of these movements and their effect on the future of power?
Sure. My research and my newest book with Maria Steffen basically points to this argument that nonviolent mass resistance has increased both in its frequency and its effectiveness in the past 50 or so years. Although it certainly existed and succeeded before that. What we argue is that when a movement is able to achieve a certain level of participation from within the society and across a number of different sectors of gender, religion, ideology, party, class, etc., they're often able to basically throw out leaders that they view as corrupt or incompetent. Even in very repressive or harsh dictatorships, they've often been able to expel foreign occupations, and they've often been able to cause secession or independence. And one of the most interesting findings is that these movements tend to be even more successful than violent insurgencies. And the reason this is interesting is because I think that it's been more or less conventional wisdom up until now that if you really want to get something done and you're a non-state actor and you don't have the monopoly on the use of force and you don't have the legitimacy of the state, you have to use violence to make that happen. And what we found actually is that these nonviolent resistance movements are more than twice as successful as their violent competitors. So ultimately what this says to me is that when large groups of people withdraw their obedience from the state and refuse to cooperate, they can affect major change in countries that have been stagnant for decades. And we're actually seeing this, I think, in what a lot of people are referring to as the Arab Spring. I think that it has such potential for changing the landscape of so many countries around the world that we're going to see its use more frequently and we're going to see its success more frequently as well.
How would you contrast what is happening now in Greece with what we saw with the Arab Spring?
Well, I think the Arab Spring has really created a demonstration effect, is what we would call it, which is basically that it's inspiring other movements around the world to also basically withdraw their obedience from the state. Not everybody is going to withdraw their obedience from the state in the same way or toward the same goals. And what I see in Greece is basically a group of people that actually have a long history of rising up against their government. And it's interesting because a lot of the reports coming out from Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have indicated that there's some brutal repression going on. So it actually shares a lot in common with a lot of what's been going on in the Arab Spring.
Giulio Gallerotti, you actually get the last word. So if you'd like to make concluding thoughts in this, feel free.
A couple of points I wanted to make is that the power game, the idea of power, national power, is very nebulous. It's a very uncertain game. Most people disagree about what it is, both scholars and national leaders. One thing that is troubling about power is that no one really knows how powerful they are, because power can only be identified and assessed when it's activated. We don't know how powerful we are before we're actually using it in a situation, whether it's a confrontation or a crisis. And it's hard to simulate a crisis or a confrontation. We can try, but we can only guess. So until that comes, we don't really know how powerful we are. Vietnam proved that we weren't very powerful, even though we thought we were. Another interesting characteristic about power and how leaders build power is that power is retrospective. Game or the process of power accumulation is retrospective. There's an old saying that we're always preparing to win the last war. And that's because people overlearn from history. Certain crises or events really dictate how we respond in terms of accumulating power in the future. A lot of experts on terrorism suggest that our approach to terrorism now is very backward-looking and not proactive. We're always trying to prevent that which happened before, but that terrorists are forward-looking, and they're always trying to find new ways of doing it. They're certainly not going to do it the way they did it before. So these are two troubling characteristics of power that suggest that it's hard for us to wrap our heads around it, and it's very, very hard for us to ensure that we're building up the kind of power that we desire.
We are out of time. There's so many more things that we could cover, perhaps in a future taping, including the three of you have all talked about democracy and that being one of the potential soft power, smart powers is advancing human rights and democracy and the United States' role in that, especially when the elections don't turn out how we like them. But for now, thank you so much for being with us. We've been speaking with Joseph Nye, who is a distinguished service professor at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. And his books include Soft Power, The Means to Success in the World Politics, The Powers to Lead, and The Future of Power. Giulio Gallerati is professor of government in the College of Social Studies at Wesleyan University. He's the author of The Power Curse, Influence and Illusion in World Politics, Cosmopolitan Power and International Relations, A Synthesis of Realism, Neoliberalism, and Constructivism. And Erica Chenoweth, professor of government at Wesleyan University, director of Wesleyan's Program on Terrorism and Insurgency Research, visiting scholar at the Institute of International Studies at University of California, Berkeley, and author of Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests, and special thanks to Ankina Aghasyan, who produces the show with me. Also, special thanks to Ishmael Karim, our assistant producer. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of this show, you can always go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives. You can keep up with us on thescholarscircle.org or armoodian.com. See you next week.